From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Today, Juan Cole, Middle East scholar and blogger, on Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Napoleon? You'll see. Then, no war, no warming. Over 60 people get arrested in Washington, D.C. on a day of civil disobedience. And what do the California fires have to do with global warming? We'll talk to environmentalist Bill McKibben. The second National Day of Climate Action is coming up in 2 weeks. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Wildfires continue to rage in Southern California. More than 500,000 people in San Diego County have been ordered to evacuate. Over 900 homes have already been destroyed. The fires extend from the Mexican border to Santa Barbara. The most devastating fires were in San Diego County. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a state of emergency.
And then we have to do everything we can to help these people to get back on their feet as quickly as possible. And I think that's why we all are here today, so that we can work together and really provide as much help as possible. But first, we have to, just pray that the wind slows down, because the wind is our number one enemy right now, and the dry weather. So we hope that this weather conditions change as quickly as possible.
At least one person has died in the fires. Another 37 have been reported injured, including 17 firefighters. At least 5,000 people have been evacuated to the football stadium where the San Diego Chargers play. One of the evacuees, Darlene Morgan, said the fires had spread throughout her neighborhood.
It's scary as heck. I have no idea what's going on. I mean, everywhere you look, the fires are burning and everything's just happening really fast. So you get in your neighborhoods and then they come through and tell you that you need to leave. So you just sit around and worry about what's going on in your neighborhood with your family and friends.
Many experts have linked the growing intensity of wildfires to drought and global warming. While much of Southern California is ablaze, more than 8 inches of rain fell in New Orleans Monday, flooding parts of the city. Mayor Ray Nagin shut City Hall early and schools across the city closed. More rain is in the forecast for today. Tensions remain high on the Turkish-Iraq border following the killing of 17 Turkish troops by Kurdish militants over the weekend. Turkey has been threatening to invade northern Iraq for days, and on Monday, Turkish troops shelled 11 towns across the Iraq border. The Guardian newspaper reports dozens of Turkish military vehicles loaded with soldiers and heavy weapons are heading toward the Iraq border. Kurdish fighters with the PKK have offered a ceasefire if Turkey abandons plans to launch cross-border raids. But Turkey has refused to negotiate with the PKK, which it considers to be a terrorist organization. Sunday's attack on the Turkish troops came just days after the Turkish parliament gave the green light for the country's forces to invade Iraq. In Baghdad, Iraqi President Jalal Talabani urged Turkey to show restraint.
America is trying to delay the attack, and the PKK has taken a wise move and said they will announce a ceasefire this evening. They will also withdraw their units from the conflict area with the Turkish army, and God willing, peace and stability will prevail in the region.
Talabani also demanded the PKK disarm and commit itself to peaceful politics or else get out of Iraq. In Washington, White House spokesperson Tony Fratto said the Kurdish militants must stop its attacks inside Turkey.
I think we are all unified, the Turks, the United States, the Iraqi government, in asking the PKK, not asking the PKK, but addressing the situation of the PKK to stop these attacks on the Turkish people and the Turkish army. It's a unified position. We want to see swift action, and we want these attacks to stop.
Earlier today, Turkey and Iraq agreed to work together to deal with the Kurdish PKK rebels in northern Iraq. President Bush has officially asked Congress to approve an additional $196 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Bush's request increased the amount of the proposed spending by $46 billion over the $150 billion already requested this year. If Congress approves the spending, it would bring the total war appropriations since the September 11th attacks to more than $800 billion. The Washington Post reports at the current rate, War appropriations could reach $1 trillion by the time President Bush leaves office, a total that by some measures would exceed the cost of the Korean and Vietnam Wars combined. President Bush also asked Congress to approve a $1.4 billion aid package over the next 3 years to fight the so-called drug war in Mexico. The requested aid marks a tenfold increase in the annual drug assistance now provided to Mexico. While President Bush is seeking nearly $200 billion to fight wars overseas, not enough money is available at home for a program to help low-income households pay their heating bills. Reuters reports about 30 million low-income American households will be left in the cold because of a lack of funding for the government's low-income home energy assistance program. The program only has enough funding to cover 16% of the 38 million poor households eligible for the program. Despite higher energy costs, the Bush administration has proposed cutting the program's budget. The Bush administration suffered a major setback after a jury in Dallas failed to convict former officials from what was once the country's largest Islamic charity, the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development. On Monday, the jury revealed it had failed to convict the five defendants of any of the 200 combined counts against them. U.S. District Judge Joe Fish declared a mistrial after three jurors said the verdict did not represent their views. In 2001, President Bush ordered the Holy Land Foundation closed and seized the charity's assets, claiming the organization had ties to the Palestinian group Hamas. Georgetown law professor David Cole described the developments as a huge defeat for the government. Cole said, quote, "They spent almost 15 years investigating this group, seized all their records, and had extensive wiretapping, and yet could not obtain a single conviction on charges of supporting a terrorist organization." The Bush administration said it plans to retry the case. In news from Lebanon, a high-ranking leader of Hezbollah has warned the United States not to set up any military bases inside Lebanon. Hezbollah said it would consider such a move a hostile act. The Lebanese newspaper Al-Safir recently reported the U.S. wants to expand its ties to the Lebanese military by building a string of U.S. military bases. Days after the report was published, Eric Edelman, the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, appeared on Lebanese television and admitted the U.S. wants to develop what he called a strategic partnership with the Lebanese army. The U.S. has increased its military assistance to Lebanon to $270 million, more than five times the amount provided a year ago. Meanwhile, a dispute continues over a U.S. military base in Ecuador. Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa has refused to renew Washington's lease on the Manta Air Base. In an interview with Reuters, Correa said he would renew the lease on one condition: the United States allow Ecuador to build a military base in Miami. Correa said, quote, "If there's no problem having foreign soldiers on a country's soil, surely they'll let us have an Ecuadorian base in the United States." It's estimated the United States has over 700 military bases in foreign countries. In other military news, nine South African soldiers died Friday when a robotic anti-aircraft cannon malfunctioned. A South African military spokesperson said the computerized gun apparently jammed and then it opened fire uncontrollably, spraying hundreds of high-explosive cannon shells. 14 soldiers were also injured. In Washington, about 60 climate change activists were arrested Monday during a series of no war, no warming actions to protest both the war in Iraq and the Bush administration's handling of global warming. Several of the arrests occurred on Capitol Hill after activists blocked the doors to the Cannon House office building. In campaign news, former Senator Mike Gravel is protesting a decision by NBC News to bar him from next Tuesday's debate at Drexel University in Philadelphia. NBC said it made the decision in part because Gravel hadn't raised over $1 million. Gravel said, quote, "The fact that NBC is owned by General Electric, one of the world's leading military contractors, is frightening and certainly smacks of censorship directed at the most outspoken critic of the influence that the military-industrial complex holds over this great nation." Those are the words of Mike Gravel. In political news, Republican Senator Mel Martinez of Florida has resigned as chair of the Republican National Committee. The Cuban-born Martinez is the Republicans' highest-ranking Latino official. His resignation came shortly after he'd expressed frustration over the tenor of the immigration debate within his party. Robert De Pasquata, president of the Republican-leaning Latino Coalition, told the Los Angeles Times Martinez's departure is especially disheartening because it follows the resignation of another high-profile Latino in the GOP, former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. De Pasquata said, quote, "The message that it sends is Latinos are not welcome. The radical conservative base has a temporary victory right now," he said. The New York Times is reporting a pair of new reports have delivered sharply critical judgments about the State Department's performance in overseeing work done by private companies in Iraq and Afghanistan. A State Department review of its own security practices in Iraq assails the department for poor coordination, communication, oversight, and accountability involving armed security companies like Blackwater and DynCorp. At the same time, a government audit expected to be released today says records documenting the work of DynCorp are in such disarray that the department cannot say specifically what it received for most of the $1.2 billion it's paid the company since 2004 to train police officers in Iraq. Meanwhile, Blackwater is also being accused of tax evasion. Congressmember Henry Waxman said Blackwater violated tax laws and may have defrauded the government of millions of dollars by designating many of its employees as independent contractors instead of company personnel. Under U.S. law, companies must pay Social Security and other federal taxes on their employees, but not for independent contractors. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has asked Congress for another $46 billion to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The request brings this year's total to more than $196 billion, by far the highest amount since the 9/11 attacks. If the trend continues, war funding could top $1 trillion by the time Bush leaves office. By some measures, that amount would exceed the cost of the Korean and Vietnam wars combined. The record-high request comes as the drumbeat continues for opening a new war with Iran. Vice President Dick Cheney warned Sunday that Iran faces serious consequences over its nuclear program and alleged role in Iraq. His comments came days after President Bush spoke for the first time of World War III if Iran obtains the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon. And the threat has been bipartisan. The three leading Democratic presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards, have all declared no option is off the table to stop Iran's nuclear program. Juan Cole is a professor of history at the University of Michigan. He runs an analytic website called Inform Comment, where he provides a daily roundup of news and events in Iraq and elsewhere in the Arab world. In his new book, Juan Cole steps back from his widely regarded analysis of contemporary politics to chronicle the first Western invasion of the Middle East since the Crusades. Napoleon's Egypt invading the Middle East is a history of France's 1798 invasion of Egypt, a conquest that still has repercussions today. Juan Cole joins us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Cole.
Thanks so much, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Before we go back in time, can you talk about this latest news, the latest threats against Iran? How serious are they? Do you think a U.S. war with Iran is imminent?
Well, I think the Cheney camp in the Bush administration very much would like to bomb the nuclear research facilities, which, as far as we know, are civilian facilities, near Isfahan. And what has been leaked from their office is that they've talked about various stratagems for getting up such an attack, and that they've been blocked so far by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and by Secretary of State Condi Rice.
And what about the shifting rationale? I mean, we saw it in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, or was it Saddam Hussein was a tyrant? That didn't fly with the U.S., so they went with WMD, and Saddam Hussein didn't have WMD. We hear about the nuclear issue, and then we hear about the shifting rationale that the American people see it as too similar to the missing WMD in Iraq, so that the rationale would be that Iranian soldiers are fighting in Iraq and killing U.S. soldiers.
Well, the most disheartening thing for the Cheney war camp must be that a recent poll shows that they've actually managed to convince the vast majority of Americans that Iran is trying to get a nuclear bomb and that Iran is actively killing U.S. troops in Iraq. Neither thing is actually in evidence. They're possible, but it hasn't been proven. But most Americans have accepted the story. And yet 78% of Americans say that they don't want a U.S. attack on Iran. So far, all of the rationales that they have trotted out and trumpeted through the media for attacking Iran have not been sufficient to convince the American people that action is necessary.
Professor Cole, I want to ask you about Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit to the U.S. last month. He spoke at Columbia University in a highly contested address. Many who criticized Columbia for hosting the event later praised Columbia President Lee Bollinger for his harsh introduction to Ahmadinejad.
I close with this comment. Frankly, and in all candor, Mr. President, I doubt that you will have the intellectual courage to answer these questions. But your avoiding them will in itself be meaningful to us. I do expect you to exhibit the fanatical mindset that characterizes so much of what you say and do. Fortunately, I'm told by experts on your country that this only further undermines your position in Iran, with all the many good-hearted, intelligent citizens there. A year ago, I am reliably told your preposterous and belligerent statements in this country, as at one of the meetings at the Council on Foreign Relations, so embarrassed sensible Iranian citizens that this led to your party's defeat in the December mayoral elections. May this do that and more. I am only a professor. I am only a professor who is also a university president. And today I feel all the weight of the modern civilized world yearning to express the revulsion at what you stand for. I only wish I could do better. Thank you.
That's Columbia University President Lee Bollinger. Professor Cole, your response.
Well, my own analysis is that Bollinger solved a problem that he had, which was that his one of his deans had invited Ahmadinejad the previous year to speak at Columbia, and Bollinger had shot that down. His faculty were angry at him for suppressing this man's freedom of speech in the United States. And so I think he felt he had to extend the invitation this year. On the other hand, he wants to rebuild the area around Columbia University. He wants to put a new theater district up there. He needs the help of the New York real estate community, many of whom are warm supporters of Israel and who would be offended by Ahmadinejad's invitation. So I think he solved the problem by inviting Ahmadinejad and so mollifying his faculty and then attacking Ahmadinejad and so mollifying his real estate backers.
What about Ahmadinejad's power in Iran?
Well, Ahmadinejad is a ceremonial president. He is a little bit more active, has stronger links to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps than his predecessor, Mohammad Khatami, who, by the way, the previous president of Iran has upbraided Ahmadinejad for his comments regarding Holocaust denial. So Ahmadinejad is not commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He can't order anybody to kill anybody. He can't launch a war. He can't launch missiles. Those powers are vested in the supreme jurisprudent, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Ahmadinejad can, cut the ribbons and open bridges and things like that. So the American right's fascination with him is entirely misplaced, and it's because he's a quirky character and he has objectionable views, and so it's easy to use him to demonize Iran.
Let me ask you about General Petraeus's report. General Petraeus spoke before Congress last month. He accused Iran of waging a proxy war inside Iraq.
6 months, we have also targeted Shia militia extremists, capturing a number of senior leaders and fighters, as well as the deputy commander of Lebanese Hezbollah Department 2800, the organization created to support the training, arming, funding, and in some cases, direction of the militia extremists by the Iranian Republican Guard Corps' Quds Force. These elements have assassinated and kidnapped Iraqi governmental leaders, killed and wounded our soldiers with advanced explosive devices provided by Iran, and indiscriminately rocketed civilians in the international zone and elsewhere. It is increasingly apparent to both coalition and Iraqi leaders that Iran, through the use of the Quds Force, seeks to turn the Iraqi special groups into a Hezbollah-like force to serve its interests and fight a proxy war against the Iraqi state and coalition forces in Iraq.
That's General Petraeus testifying before Congress. Professor Cole, your response.
Well, the whole story doesn't make much sense to me. The main backers of Iran in Iraq are the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which was formed in Iran at the suggestion of Ayatollah Khomeini by Iraqi Shiite expatriates, and has a paramilitary, the Butter Corps, which is trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. The Butter Corps and the Supreme Council are America's closest allies among the Shiites of Iraq. I think this is really a jealous girlfriend story. I think the U.S. wants the fundamentalist Shiite parties and militias for itself. It doesn't want to have to compete with Iran for their affection, for clientelage, and so is slamming Iran as a way of driving a wedge between them. All of the Iranian personnel that have been kidnapped by the United States, detained by the United States, have been found in territory of U.S. allies. Abdulaziz al-Hakim, the leader of the Supreme Council, or up in Erbil among our Kurdish allies. So the idea that the Iranians are building up rogue units of the nativist Mahdi army, who are slum kids in Iraq, don't like Iran, I don't know. It doesn't strike me as very likely. And I think that the U.S. military is getting bad intelligence on these things from some of its contacts, including the cult-like terrorist organization, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, which Saddam used against Iran and which the Pentagon is still using against Iran.
And the fact that there are more Saudi fighters in Iraq than Iranian, but that is almost never raised, either in the press or by the administration? We're going
to my knowledge, the United States has never captured any Iranian with arms. There were 136 foreign detainees, the last we knew. There are 24,000 Iraqi ones. And the 136 contain no Iranians at all. 45% of them earlier in the summer were Saudis. I think that proportion has changed, but it's such a small number. But in any case, there is no proof of any actual Iranian military activity inside Iraq whatsoever.
Finally, on the issue of Iran, the resignation of the nuclear negotiator, Ali Larijani, what is the significance of this?
Well, it's very bad news in many ways. It's a sign that President Ahmadinejad, who does have the power to appoint ambassadors and some of the diplomatic corps, in conjunction with the approval of the Supreme Leader Khamenei, is gradually putting his people into place. Larijani was a very experienced diplomat, well-liked among his European interlocutors, and is being replaced by someone of far less experience, who, however, is close to Ahmadinejad. So it's cronyism. I think it's a very bad move on Iran's part, and it probably worsens their posture with regard to these negotiations over their nuclear program.
We're going to break. When we come back to Professor Cole, we're going to talk about Turkey, Iraq, and what the invading army of Napoleon in Egypt has to do with today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Juan's Cole's report book is called Napoleon's Egypt. Stay with us. Shiraz by Sharif here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Professor Juan Cole, professor of history, University of Michigan. He's joining us from Ann Arbor, from the campus. He runs an analytic website called Informed Comment and has written a new book called Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East. Let's go to today's top story, tension remaining high on the Turkish-Iraq border following the killing of 17 Turkish troops by Kurdish militants over the weekend. How significant is this?
Well, it's extremely significant. I mean, imagine what would happen in this country if a guerrilla group based in a neighboring country came over the border and killed 17 U.S. troops. That would be a war. The Kurdish guerrilla movement, the Kurdish Workers Party, based in now in Iraq, but originally from eastern Anatolia, from the Turkish regions, is conducting a guerrilla war against the Turkish military. It is being given safe harbor by Kurdish politicians on the Iraqi side. And in essence, the United States has created this situation in which a NATO ally, people forget, Turkey fought alongside the United States in Korea. It's got troops in Afghanistan. A NATO ally of the United States is being attacked and its troops killed by a terrorist organization, so designated by the State Department, that it essentially has U.S. auspices. The U.S. Is responsible for security in Iraq.
And how connected is the U.S. to the PKK, or is it at all?
Well, the United States doesn't like the PKK and doesn't have much connection to it, but the United States has allied with the Iraqi Kurdish leaders, who are the most reliable allies of the United States in Iraq, Masoud Barzani and Jalal Talabani. And Barzani in particular, it seems to me, just de facto is giving harbor to giving haven to these PKK guerrillas. So the United States needs Barzani. It needs his support. He's doing an oil deal with Hunt Oil, which is close to the Bush administration. His Peshmerga paramilitary is the backbone of the most effective fighters of the new Iraqi army. They do security details in other cities like Mosul and Kirkuk. The U.S. Really desperately depends on the Kurdistan Regional Authority and its paramilitary, and can't afford to alienate Barzani. And since Barzani is behind the scenes, seems to kind of like the PKK and is giving them a haven, the U.S. Is politically complicit in these attacks.
What is the deal with Hunt Oil?
Well, the Hunt Oil, which is, I think, losing its bids in Yemen, is desperate for a new field to develop, and they're exploring a partnership with the Kurdistan Regional Authority in northern Iraq.
And the issue of the U.S. Congress taking a vote within one of its committees, Foreign Relations Committee, that Turkey was involved in a genocide against the Armenians. The significance of that vote, though it's expected to fail at a congressional level with the whole Congress voting, and how it has played in Turkey, leading to the parliament vote to invade northern Iraq.
Well, I really here would underline that as a historian, I think it's important that everybody understand the horrible things that were done to the Armenians during World War I. On the other hand, it's my duty also to try to understand the Turkish contemporary response, which is that the United States has made enormous trouble for this close ally. Turkey has put itself out over the last decades to help the United States. It was an ally in the Cold War. It was an ally in the Gulf War. In return, the United States seems to have told Turkey, drop dead. I mean, they invaded Iraq against Turkish advice. They have unleashed Shiite fundamentalism, Sunni fundamentalism, Kurdish separatism on Turkey's doorstep. There's now a resurgence of the PKK and terrorism against Turkish citizens. And now, on top of all this trouble the United States is making for the Turks, the U.S. Congress was set to condemn the Ottoman government of Turkey, the predecessor government to the present one, for this genocide against the Armenians. So the Turks are hurt and confused. In Bill Clinton's last year, 56% of the Turkish public thought well of the United States. That number is down to 9%. So it's not entirely clear what motive the United States has in so alienating a country that has been a valued and close ally.
The question of history informing what's happening today. Professor Cole, you've just written the book Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East. Give us the context of that time and how that has parallels to today.
Well, in a way, it's a remarkable story. The young French Republic, having made this revolution and proclaimed the rights of man, was under attack by a number of foreign enemies, monarchies that opposed the Republican principle, among them England. And the British had naval superiority in the Mediterranean. They had a building colony in India, where they had won a war with the French. The French were kicked out of India by the British. And so Napoleon Bonaparte, at the time when he was still a general, hadn't come to power, came up with this idea of a strike at Ottoman Egypt as a way of creating a French Mediterranean, of blocking British naval superiority, and of threatening the British colony in India. And so he convinced the French government to fund this massive expedition, 50,000 men. And he went off to Egypt, of course, easily conquered it. It was a small country compared to France. But then the British sank his fleet or chased it away, and the French soldiers were trapped in Egypt, and they faced repeated insurgencies and attrition. Bonaparte had proclaimed that he was going to liberate the Egyptians from tyranny, that he was going to install a democratic government. His officers expressed confidence in their memoirs that the Egyptians would be grateful for this bestowal of liberty by a Western power. So there are many resonances to today's quagmire in Iraq.
The graffiti of French soldiers still seen on the pyramids?
Well, it was an expedition that deeply marked modern Egypt. It was the time when the Rosetta Stone was discovered, although not deciphered until much later, that allowed the recovery of ancient Egyptian civilization. But it was also a very brutal occupation. Bonaparte, if a village rebelled, would order it burned, its men killed. He did this over and over again. The letters are very clear about the brutality of the policy. It was a take-no-prisoner kind of policy in many instances. And even his own officers began to complain that Bonaparte was increasingly acting like the old French monarchy in an arbitrary way or like an Oriental potentate. And Bonaparte himself attempted to fool the Egyptians into thinking that Enlightenment French deism, which rejects the Trinity and was opposed to the Pope and the Roman Catholic hierarchy, was essentially a form of Islam. So the Egyptians shouldn't mind so much being ruled by the French.
What about how the role of women changed under Napoleon, Egyptian women?
Well, under Napoleon, many restrictions on women were lifted. The Egyptian male chroniclers complained bitterly that the French started going out with women. They appeared publicly. They went to the dances together. From an Egyptian Muslim point of view, this was licentiousness and libertinism. But they do admit that the women themselves became intrigued with this new freedom of movement, that they were walking in the streets and laughing and unveiled and The male chroniclers were fit to be tied by this change. But it should be remembered, most Egyptian women were peasants. They were not much affected by French policy. And a lot of Egyptian women were victimized by the French, either as mistresses or even as slaves. The French bought women as slaves and used them that way. So it was a mixed picture.
What, Juan Cole, caused the French eventually to leave Egypt?
Well, Bonaparte himself tried to break out of his box once the fleet was destroyed by taking Syria, but he couldn't succeed in that. The Ottoman forces fought him off, and he therefore slipped out of Egypt after about a year. And he had done propaganda back in France that his victories were glorious. So he came back and used his Egyptian so-called victory as a platform for making a coup and coming to power as first consul. But his troops were stuck in Egypt. He kind of abandoned them for another 2 years. Ultimately, the British and the Ottomans made an alliance, and the British gave naval support to an Ottoman expeditionary force that defeated the French. And the soldiers were transported back to France on Egyptian, on British vessels in a rather humiliating way.
How long was the occupation?
3 years.
What about parallels to today? Do you see parallels to how the U.S. would leave?
Well, no, because in that time, it was a multipolar world, and France had lots of enemies, including the British and the Russians, who could ally with the Ottomans, and the local Muslim forces found Western Christian allies against the French. In our day, it's a unipolar world. There's only one superpower. There's no other country that would be willing to help the Iraqi guerrilla movement against the United States in an open sort of way. And so the United States, in some ways, is in a much better position than the French were, but it still faces many of the same problems: lack of legitimacy, the rejection of a Muslim people, of rule by essentially a Christian nation, an ongoing attrition and insurgency, volunteers coming from Mecca, which happened also against the French. So the United States position in Iraq is tenuous. It's not as tenuous as the French position had been in Egypt. But it just goes to show that the course of Western colonialism in the Middle East doesn't flow smoothly.
Do you see the war expanding?
The Iraq war could expand very easily. I mean, we don't know, of course, the future, but now we begin to see that the Kurdish separatism in northern Iraq is causing severe tensions and possibly military conflict with Turkey. There's a possibility of increased Sunni volunteers if the Shiites were to massacre any large number of Sunni Arabs. And especially, it seems likely that the U.S. will gradually draw down troops in the next 2 and 3 years if it leaves behind it substantial instability and there are massacres. It could draw in the neighbors. You could have a proxy war. And these things are dangerous to the world economy because the Persian Gulf is the source of a very substantial amount of the world's energy. And that energy production could be interrupted by such a guerrilla war.
And the news,
so it's a very, very dangerous situation.
The news from Lebanon that a high-ranking leader of Hezbollah has warned the United States not to set up any military bases inside Lebanon, Hezbollah saying it would consider such move a hostile act, and the U.S. increasing their military assistance to Lebanon to $270 million, more than five times the amount they provided a year ago.
Well, to tell you the truth, Amy, I think the idea of putting a U.S. military base in Lebanon, which is an unstable country and has a very large Shiite militia, is a brain-dead idea. And I can't imagine that the Lebanese government itself will be so stupid as to go forward with this. And up until recently, of course, Hezbollah, which opposes this plan, and which has a substantial number of deputies in the Lebanese parliament, was part of a national unity government. That's broken down for the moment. It may come back. It seems to me that the politics of that move would be awfully fraught.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Juan Cole, professor of history, University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us from Ann Arbor. His blog is called Informed Comment. His new book is Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, what do the fires in Southern California have to do with global warming? Stay with us. Jules here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. No war, no warming. The theme of a day of civil disobedience in Washington, D.C. Monday. Hundreds of people converged on the U.S. Capitol building to protest the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Bush administration's record on climate change. At least 61 people were arrested after some blocked a street near the Cannon House office building. Some of the protesters were in polar bear costumes. Before the arrests, independent journalist Robin Bell of Bell Visuals caught the polar bear's arrival at the Capitol building.
Money for health care, not for war. Tax the rich to help the poor. Homes not jails, books not bars, bikes not bombs, clean steel cars, jobs in organic, wind and solar. Help the poor while we're helping the polar. Jobs in solar, wind and organic. Help the people while we're helping the planet. We want answers. We got some chance here. The world could be burning. We got to be turning.
The musical voices of the polar bear protesters among the hundreds who took part in the No War, No Warming Day of Action in Washington Monday, the video courtesy of Robin Bell of BellVisuals.com. Ted Glick was one of the organizers of the protest, coordinator of the U.S. Climate Emergency Council, now in the 50th day of a climate emergency fast, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Ted, how much weight have you lost?
Somewhere around 35 pounds.
And the purpose yesterday, were you one of those more than 60 people arrested?
I was. I was arrested as part of what was the fifth wave of a series of actions, coordinated affinity groups that took action throughout the morning. It was actually a great day.
What are you trying to accomplish? What are the connections that you're making?
Well, I think most people understand that the Iraq war is all about oil. It's a war for oil. It has nothing to do with terrorism. It's made things worse in terms of al-Qaeda and terrorism. Everybody sees that. It's got a functioning brain. It's not influenced by the propaganda of this administration. It's a war for oil. We get the oil. We burn the oil. We heat up the earth. We aggravate and make worse conditions of life for people all over the world as global warming has its impacts. Droughts, floods, sea level rise. That's going to lead to more and more climate refugees, going to increase conflict, lead to more war. It's a vicious cycle. We have to end these wars, get off of our war addiction and our fossil fuel addiction, move to clean energy, be about justice, be about peace, be about clean energy. That's the way forward. This action was all about beginning to shift into a different direction by taking stronger action. The peace movement, the climate movement, the justice movements, we need to be coming together, and we need to be stepping up our tactics, stepping up our actions, and letting our government know we are not going to accept what they are doing, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. The reality is, a year after the Democrats took over Congress, virtually nothing has changed as far as the major issues, in particular in terms of the war, in particular in terms of warming. And that's why we were out there. That's why many of us got arrested. And this is just the beginning. This is not the end of anything.
Ted Gluck, thanks very much for being with us, one of the organizers of Monday's No War, No Warming protests, a coordinator of the U.S. Climate Emergency Council. On the 50th day of a climate emergency, fast, one of the more than 60 people arrested in Washington. As we continue on this issue of global warming, what does global warming have to do with the fires raging in Southern California? More than 500,000 people in San Diego County have been ordered to evacuate. Over 900 homes have been destroyed. At least one person has died. Another 37 people have been reported injured, including 17 firefighters. The fires extend from the Mexican border to Santa Barbara, the most devastating fires in San Diego County. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a state of emergency. Bill McKibben is a leading environmentalist and one of the leading forces behind Step It Up. In 1989, he wrote the book The End of Nature, one of the first books to describe global warming as an emerging environmental crisis. His latest book is called Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Bill McKibben joining us from Boston. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Amy, it's good to be with you, as always.
It's good to have you with us. The fires in Southern California and global warming, is there a connection?
I'm afraid that there is. This is the kind of disaster that we see more and more of as we begin to change the basic physics and chemistry of the planet we live on. One of the people leading the really brave rescue effort out there yesterday said, one of the San Diego authorities said, this is the driest it's been in at least 90 years. It's dry because they've had terrific heat and not much rain. And those are just the conditions for that part of the world that all the modeling suggests come about when you begin to raise the temperature.
I wanted to ask you about Tom Swetnam of the University of Arizona, one of the ecologists there. He's written about the connection to global warming. He published a study in the journal Science saying global warming has increased temperatures in the West about 1 degree, and that's caused 4 times more fires.
This is the problem. Things don't work in a linear, smooth relationship, you know. You raise the temperature a little bit, and you begin to get very large cascading effects. So, for instance, across much of the West and Alaska, warmer temperatures have brought with them infestations of new kinds of insects. Those insects have killed off hundreds of thousands of square miles of forest. That forest catches fire once those trees die. All that burning forest sends yet more carbon into the atmosphere, on and on and on. We see the same kind of dynamics playing out now with this drought in the Southeast, with the ongoing drought in the Southwest. And of course, the U.S. has been hit less hard by these changes than much of the rest of the world so far. What's important to remember, and the reason that we spend all our time organizing now, trying to change all this, is that so far human beings have raised the temperature of the planet about 1 degree Fahrenheit. The computer modeling makes it very clear that before the century is out, unless we take very strong action indeed, we're going to raise the temperature of the planet another 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So take whatever you see now, multiply it by 5, and then toss in all those cascading effects that come as we exceed one threshold after another.
And yet we hardly see, with the massive coverage of what's going on in California, which is very significant, these fires raging in Southern California, the words global warming mentioned.
Well, it's like Katrina. I mean, the sheer horror of it in the moment is so enormous that it's hard to focus on causes. That's why we've got to be building that movement all the time, doing the kind of stuff that Ted Glick is doing in Washington, doing the kind of stuff that at StepItUp07.org we're doing all across the country as we get ready for our next round of big nationwide protests on November 3rd. It's only, you know, when we're able to take a step back. I mean, you know, the people in California today can't be concentrating on global warming. They've got to be concentrating on getting people out of harm's way and fast. And my aunt was evacuated yesterday afternoon. I'm worried sick about her. But the rest of us,
where does she live?
She lives near San Diego. The rest of us can't be in there fighting fires. You know, we're thousands of miles away. What we can be doing is trying to put out or at least damp down the big fire that's causing all these other effects. And that's global warming. And that can only be done with federal action soon. That's what we're pushing for on November 3rd.
I want to go to New Orleans for a minute. You mentioned Hurricane Katrina. They are experiencing massive rainstorm, at least 8 inches yesterday. The forecast, it will continue. Mayor Ray Nagin closed City Hall. They closed the schools. They told people not to drive in the streets. The waves, they were afraid, would inundate the buildings that have just been cleaned up from Hurricane Katrina. That connection?
Look, when you raise the warm air holds more water vapor than cold air does, right? That means that in arid areas, you get more evaporation and hence more drought, and we're seeing that around the world. Once that water is up there in the atmosphere, it's got to come down someplace. In wet areas or in big storms, we see way more precipitation. The number of storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period has grown by something like 25%, the real gully washers. To call it global warming is correct, but almost a misnomer. What we're really doing is adding immense amounts of energy to a system. And that energy is expressing itself in all kinds of ways. More evaporation, more precipitation, higher wind speeds, rapid melt of ice across the Arctic and across every glacial system that we know about. On and on and on. We used to think that we were still a decade or two away from the real emergency. That's what we would have said 20 years ago when I wrote The End of Nature. Now we understand, the modeling makes clear, that the planet was more finely balanced than we've understood. What we've done so far has been enough to throw every physical system on Earth out of kilter. What we're fighting for now is not to prevent global warming. There's going to be some global warming. There already is. What we're fighting for now is to keep that miserable and difficult century of global warming from turning into an absolute catastrophe that rewrites the geology and biology of this planet for eons to come.
Bill McKibben, in the Southeast, several states are in the midst of a major drought. As of last week, 71 of North Carolina's 100 counties were in exceptional drought, the federal government's highest classification. Georgia has declared a state of emergency, appealed for federal aid. The drought has also affected large swathes of Alabama, Tennessee, South Carolina.
When you increase the temperature, what you're really doing, I mean, if I say the temperature's gone up 1 degree, it doesn't sound like much. But that masks enormous increases in the extremes, much longer and stronger heat waves. We keep having one record warm year after another across this globe. And that doesn't happen without consequences. The Earth is a physical system, and those inputs start to change the outputs pretty darn dramatically.
The action that you're planning as one of the lead forces behind Step It Up on November 3rd, can you talk about what your demands are? You say the federal government has to take action.
Absolutely. We're talking about three things at stepitup07.org. One of them is the same call for an 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050 that we called for last spring when we organized 1,400 demonstrations in all 50 states. Those demonstrations were very successful in getting that demand deep into the agenda. It went from being a kind of radical and fringe idea to being very much part of the legislative mix that's reflected in what Congress is thinking about now. Second demand is that we need an immediate moratorium on new coal-fired power. No such thing, at least at the moment, as clean coal. It's dirty where it comes from, and it's dirty when we burn it. And that, you know, if we build any significant percentage of the 150 coal-fired power plants now on the books, then the discussion about dealing with global warming is moot. We will put so much carbon in the atmosphere that we can't control it. Third thing, we need to make sure that the big economic transition that's coming with global warming, with fighting global warming, the move to a new set of energy sources doesn't leave behind the same people that our last economy left behind. So we're stressing very hard this Green Jobs for All campaign. What we're trying to do this time is find out which of our politicians are actually going to become leaders. People who go to the stepitup07.org website can use the nifty new invite tool devised by my colleagues, all of whom are 22 and 23 and who actually know how the internet really works. And with this neat tool, they can easily invite their senators, congressmen, and the presidential candidates to come appear at one of these hundreds of rallies that will be taking place across the country on November 3rd. They can find out where in their community people will be gathering to make their voices heard. We need a movement as strong, as willing to sacrifice, as morally urgent, as passionate as the civil rights movement was a generation ago. If we don't get it soon, and we have a real time limit here, if we don't get it soon, then we're not going to be able to force the changes that we need over the power of the very strong vested interest that would like to keep things the way they are, even though it's now destabilizing the planet in the most powerful and most tragic ways. Those pictures of that smoke pouring out of those canyons in California should remind us at the deepest level what's at stake and what we can do to help right now.
Bill McKibben, you mentioned Congress. What about the presidential candidates, the Democratic presidential candidates? What about the Democrat-led Congress, both the House and the Senate? What are they doing to deal with this crisis?
They're getting closer. They've started. We haven't done anything about climate change for the 20 years that we've known about it. I mean, literally, zip, zilch, nothing in Washington. Finally, this year, there's legislation on the table. There's very good legislation from Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Henry Waxman. That bill is being watered down at the moment by Senator Lieberman of Connecticut and Senator Warner of Virginia. It's a big fight as to what kind of bill will go through. It may not matter unbelievably at the moment because President Bush is going to veto whatever happens. We do need, however, to get the framework for strong legislation, and then we need to make sure that whoever wins the presidency really steps up to this challenge.
What about before? This is the chance that constituencies have all over the country to make demands of candidates, and then afterwards, I don't want to say hold their feet to the fire, given the what's happening right now.
I think that would be, in fact, an appropriate and correct thing to say right now. That's what we're trying very hard to do. Look, the presidential candidates, the Democrats, have so far mostly said the right things. After our demonstrations on April 14th, all the leading candidates signed on to this Sanders bill for 80% reduction. However, none of them have yet shown that they're determined to make the central organizing principle of their presidency, which it pretty much has got to be. This is the biggest thing human beings have ever done, and if we don't get on it right away, none of the other issues will matter. We'll find out on November 3rd which of these people show up to talk to America about this question, and we'll find out what they say, whether or not they're going to go beyond saying the right thing and starting to work and offering
solemn assurance. Bill McKibben, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us. November 3rd declared a day against global warming. They're stepping it up. And that does it for our show. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.